Good evening. I'm Glenn Lowry, the Director of the Museum of Modern Art, and welcome to our final spring session of Artists Speak, Conversations on Contemporary Art. I want to thank the Contemporary Arts Council of the Museum of Modern Art for their continued and sustained support of this program. I also want to thank in advance Li Mingwei and Tino Segal, who have joined us this evening for tonight's discussion. Eat, sleep, and pray, everyday rituals in contemporary art. We're delighted that they're here, and I hope that by bringing them together, we'll generate a stimulating conversation for all of us. Many artists incorporate quotidian activities in their work, blurring the boundaries between art and life, performance and social engagement, and singular authorship and group collaboration. Li Mingwei and Tino Segal play with all of these creative elements in distinct ways and challenge traditional perceptions of what art, education, authenticity, everyday encounters, and social experiences can be. An experience, in fact, is their medium, moving the focus away from the material object and thus radically disrupting what we expect to see in a museum or a gallery and opening us up to how art can unfold outside of traditional museum space. Born in Taiwan and currently living in New York City, Li Mingwei has a dual Buddhist Catholic background. As a child, he spent summers at a Chan monastery, where he learned the simple power of concentrating on daily activities. He then came to live in the United States and attended a Benedictine high school in California. He earned a BFA in textile arts from the California College of Arts in 1993 and an MFA in new genre public art from Yale University in 1997. He is a social conceptualist whose medium is hospitality. He creates both participatory installations where strangers can explore issues of trust, intimacy, and self-awareness on their own, and one-on-one events where visitors explore and examine these issues with the artist through eating, sleeping, walking, and conversation. Mingwei's projects are often open-ended scenarios for everyday interaction and take on different forms depending on the participants. Time is central to this process, as his installations often change during the course of an exhibition. He's had solo exhibitions here at the Museum of Modern Art, the Whitney Museum of American Art, Los Angeles County Museum of Art, the Cleveland Museum of Contemporary Art, Fabric Workshop and Museum, the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, and the Queensland Gallery of Modern Art, as well as the Taipei Museum of Contemporary Art. And he's been featured in the Venice, Liverpool, and Taipei Biennials, as well as the Whitney Biennial, and many others. Tino Segal was born in London in 1976 and currently lives and works in Berlin. He has developed a radical artistic practice that takes the form of live encounters between people. What all of Segal's works have in common is that they reside only in the space and time they occupy, and in the memory of the work and its reception. Over the past 9 years, he has been known for making art without actually making any objects. His working method involves organizing and instructing people to use their body and or voice to construct situations that are experienced. Having studied political economy and choreography, Segal's work proposes a process of production that revolves around exchanges and transformations of thoughts. Tino will have a solo exhibition at the Guggenheim Museum here in New York in January of 2010. He's also had solo shows at the Kunsthaus Zurich, the Fondazione Nicola Trussardi in Milan, the Institute of Contemporary Art in London, the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam, the Kunsthaus Bregenz in Austria, the Art Gallery of Ontario in Toronto, Hamburger Kunstverein in Germany, and many other places. He has participated in the Lyon and Moscow Biennials and represented Germany in the 2005 Venice Biennial. He also participated in the Tate and Yokohama Triennials and Manifesta Frankfurt. His work will be included in the forthcoming Il Tempo del Postino at Theatre Basel, Art 40 Basel. He received the Balois Art Prize at Art Basel in Switzerland in 2004 and the Kunstpreis der Butcherstrasse in Bremen, Germany in 2003. As usual in these conversations, Li Mingwei will begin with a presentation of his work, and then we'll all take the stage, as it were, and engage in a conversation. Mingwei?
Thank you, Glenn. Thank you, Tino. I'm going to spend the next 15 to 20 minutes just to share with you four projects I have done, starting from the very, very early performance project I did in 1994. This project is called Money for Art. As you can see, it's a $10 bill. And what I did is I went to a cafe in San Francisco and made nine of these Money for Art projects. And when I was making it, people were quite curious of what I was doing. So when they came over, I said, would you like to have this piece of artwork? They always say yes. But what they needed to do for me is to give me their phone number so I can call them back every 6 months. So 6 months later, you can see somebody used it to buy moccasins and somebody used it to buy food. The lady down there, Jennifer, who opened it up and used to buy Haagen-Dazs and banana, I asked her, why does she do that? Because for this project, it's not really about you should do this or shouldn't do that. It's more about what is that moment about. She said she was so hungry, she didn't want to have that piece of artwork, a $10 artwork, so she just dismantled it and used it to buy food. So 12 months later, somebody said it was stolen. I think he was a little bit embarrassed to tell me he used it for something else. The person over here, John, the homeless person, was very interesting because I was a little bit cautious of inviting someone who is a homeless person that being a part of the money project. But he said, yes, he would love to do it. So after 12 months, he still has it. Whenever I go back to San Francisco, I'll make more for him because whenever his friends come, he will stretch it in his hand and say, look, I have a piece of artwork. And nobody ever say that. Why don't you use it for something else, you know, to buy yourself food? So now he has about 12 of them in his pocket. So in a gallery format, I ask people to exchange something that is of equivalent value, and it's up to you to decide what is equivalent right there, just to show you what people exchange with. For example, somebody put a bottle of empty Prozac up there. I wonder what happened. I also ask people to leave their name and profession on the paper for me, just for documentation purpose. So somebody actually took my paper sculpture without leaving anything on there. And under the profession, she wrote thief. So she really got the project. Okay. The second project is called The Tourist. And this was a project commissioned by MoMA in 2003, working with curator Roxana Marcos. Instead of showing the MoMA version, I think I'm going to show you the one I did in Sydney, because most of you have seen this project already at MoMA, and you know New York quite well, so we'll take a tour in Sydney. This project was inspired by my little nephew, who was 6 years old when I went visit him in Rome. He said, when I arrived in Rome, he said, Uncle, let me take you to see Roman Forum. And I thought, oh, how fantastic, a 6 years old version of Roman Forum. When we arrived there, I mean, he had a camera, I had a camera. Instead of showing these historical relics, he pointed out all these litters of kitten that lives in Roman Forum. So we went around the whole city looking at his friends, which were cats, and taking pictures. And I thought, this is fantastic how a little six-year-old Roman kid relates to Roman Forum. So in the gallery, what I did is I asked 20 volunteers to show me their version of Sydney. And when we go there, we take images and also object back and sound. And it's a cumulative project. When you come to the gallery, you see the first day, it's only one trip. The second day, two trips. And again, so it changes during the duration of the show. I'll show you three trips very quickly. So someone took me on his yacht to go to the Sydney Harbor. As you can see, it was not a very friendly day. He made the mistake of asking me to be behind the wheel, and the boat was tilting so much that I had to hide in there. And this is right across the harbor. Okay. Okay. Yeah. And this is the Sydney Bridge. And we ended the whole day with a firework, absolutely beautiful. The second trip was given to me by a trapeze specialist who works in the Olympic Stadium. So we went to experience the trapeze. I didn't have the bravery of getting up there and play with them. So I was just down there experiencing, even just watching them, it just gave me goosebumps. Okay. So the third trip is given to me by a rabbi, and he took me to see where he taught in terms of kindergarten, but also took me to see where he performed service. And the most haunting experience was that we went downstairs where he prepared the deceased body before they were being presented in the temple. And of course, I did not take image of that because it would be a disrespectful thing to do. So that back in the gallery, what we had is that we also got objects back to the gallery, so you can see where these objects came from and also images and sound. I do have to say this is a very inexpensive way of me to travel and see different cities. Okay. The third project is called the Bodhi Tree Project. This was commissioned by the Queensland Gallery of Modern Art to create a public art project. And as most of you know, that Buddha was sitting under a Bodhi tree when he was enlightened. That was 2,500 years ago. Around 300 BC, there was a massive eradication of Buddhism happening in northern India. And there was a princess by the name of Ashoka, who went into the palace, because they actually built a palace and temples around this original tree that Buddha was sitting under. She went in there because she knew people were coming to cut down this tree. So she went in there, took a branch, hit in her hair, and escaped to Ceylon, which is Sri Lanka right now. This is a picture depicting her escaping to Ceylon. So my project was to work with the Sri Lankan government and the high priest and the villager so I can go to that particular tree, which is planted in Annapurna at this moment, to bring a sapling from that tree again and plant it at the ground of Gallery Modern Art, not only as a tree, but also as a sacred object. So it took us 4 years to convince the government that this is a genuine act. And a week before my arrival, villagers were sitting around the mother tree, chanting to the mother tree 24/7 to prepare for the eventual departure of this sapling. And underneath the parasol was that sapling. Everybody lined up to touch this holy object before her departure. So this is that little sapling. And everyone's sitting around the mother tree, chanting to the mother tree. So the high priest handed me the sapling. And for all this time, he was chanting in Pali. But when he handed it to me, he actually spoke in English, and I think it was for my sake. He said to the tree, "You're going to go to a very beautiful, exotic land that no Bodhi tree ever ventured. And your job is to become as healthy and as big as you can and create, cast shadow for the children and animal there." So after that, I was literally shaking and thinking, accidentally I might kill the tree. So we walked around the mother tree, and here she was. Instead of carrying her on to Qantas Airline, I couldn't do that. I had to put her on DHL and send it to Brisbane. And they actually do that with living animal with DHL. So she was in the quarantine for about 6 months. And the person who was taking care of her, she actually was from Sri Lanka and lived very close to the temple. Somehow it just happened that way. And she was so grateful that she was given the task to take care of this holy object. So I went back to the Gallery of Modern Art last May, and during Buddha's birthday, planted the tree with the Buddhist community there. From that point on, this tree will grow to 4,000 years. And remember, it came from a 2,500 years old sapling. So I hope the museum will outlast the tree, but we'll see. Yes. This is my last project called Guernica in Sand. And most of you know that Picasso painted this in 1937 in response to the bombing of Guernica. And my very first encounter of this painting was on my way leaving from Taiwan to go live in Santo Domingo in late 1970s. It actually was in MoMA when I first saw it. I was so shocked because the only kind of painting I've seen in Taiwan were beautiful silk painting, flowers and birds. And when my parents showed me this, they told me that it's a politically based work. And my parents being political dissidents, it meant a lot to them. So it really, the kind of shock and awe really stayed with me. And so 3 years later, what I did, I mean, not 3 years, 3 years before, what I did is I create a very large sand painting. This looks like a sand painting, but it's actually a performative piece. So here, you can see it's not finished, and there are three phases to this work. The first phase is the first 6 weeks of the exhibition. You come and see this piece, realizing that the second phase is going to happen during the seventh week on Monday morning at sunrise. So that very morning at sunrise, I go down there to start finishing that little piece. This is also a signal that someone can go down there and start walking on the sand painting, one person at a time. So it's really about the dynamic between the person who is creating it and the person who is walking on it. And this project is very much about impermanence and what is it that when things constantly change in front of you and when you're changing things. So this whole process of walking and creation lasted for the whole day. And as you can imagine, there are hundreds of people watching the dynamic between these two people. And this, it's always one person at a time, and people can stand and sit around the rock and watch what I'm doing and think about what they have just done. At the very last moment, which is when the sun sets, I stop people walking on it, spend time just patching up what people did, but of course it's useless because it's just completely changed, transformed. Spend some time watching, and then at the actual sunset moment, I and three other assistants took brooms and started brushing the painting toward the middle. And that's how we ended the whole performance piece at that very end of the day. We left it like this for the next 6 weeks of the show, also with a small DVD of recording what was it like and what happened so they know where this thing came from. So this is what it looked like at sunset, and this was what it looked like at sunrise that morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ming-Wei.
My pleasure.
Those are terrific projects.
Thank you.
I think we'll turn to Tino now. And maybe, Tino, you would talk for a few moments on sort of the way you think about issues of ritual and sort of time and ritual and sort of daily activity.
Okay. Thanks, Glenn, and also Laura Bellis for inviting me to this talk, and thank you, Mei, for this interesting presentation. I think that the word ritual for me is quite an important word, actually, in my thinking of my own practice, but actually both my own practice, but also in what art also today still is. And I think that there maybe is a slight difference in how it's presented here for this talk, or in the little leaflet where it says something like incorporate rituals into their work. You know? So there's an idea that there's something like a ritual which has to then be incorporated into what we call art today. And what I'm about to say now is it's not necessarily something that which comes from me, but which is important to me. It's like there's been a number of museum studies, people who've who've written books like Carol Duncan's Civilizing Rituals, so that the museum itself is a civilizing ritual which has certain goals. And one way, I guess, of seeing my work is to kind of slightly reconfigure this ritual for it to have slightly different goals. And I'll try to map out for a bit what I think initially they were, and maybe what I'd like to slightly alter. So first of all, what do we understand by this word of ritual? I think what we can agree upon is that it's a kind of transitional experience where you kind of go from one state to another, or you ritually enact values which are important for your society. I think we can probably all agree on that. And I think that the museum is exactly that. The exhibition is exactly that. And it's a fairly new ritual. It's a ritual which is 200-300 years old. Starts with probably something like the Louvre. And it's quite interesting if one looks at, for example, British social reformers at the beginning of the museum, they never actually speak about art. Like a probably more conventional way of seeing the museum today is like a place which classifies objects. But if you look at these social reformers, they're all about, you know, how will people behave in there? They're supposed to be quiet, but also it gives them opportunity, gives people of lower class opportunity to look at people of higher class, how they comport themselves, how they dress, and also of themselves, to see these people of higher class in their individuality, and also think of themselves as individuals rather than as themselves as part of a collective, or in England, you know, a big problem, a drinking mob. Yeah? Like, so this was definitely a problem, especially in England, that you can see at the genesis of the museum, it's something for the working class men also to do on the weekend so that they don't get as loaded. And now this doesn't come from me. This comes from museum studies, a person called Tony Bennett. They have this idea for the Monday, where the productivity of the Monday is lost because people are still drunk. So the idea of the museum, and this is quite radical, and I think that we tend to forget this nowadays. It's really a ritual which is supposed to teach us that we are individuals. Now, that is something very new. It sounds very kind of natural almost to us, but it's, you know, my view and a lot of other people's view, it's definitely a construction. It's quite new. It's probably a 20th century thing that we understand ourselves as individuals, and first and foremost as individuals. If you think, for example, like even I always have this in my head, like Mrs. Theodore Roosevelt. You know, you'd say Mrs. Theodore, not Mrs. Roosevelt, but Mrs. Theodore Roosevelt, which is quite amazing. So this woman is first and foremost the kind of her position is first of all the wife of this other person. She's not first and foremost herself, so like we would say today, Michelle Obama. So there's obviously a whole history of individualization which has happened, which goes much further back, where we would think of ourselves not even as just, you know, part of a small family or part of a couple, but part of a nation or part of a tribe or something, before we would think of ourselves as ourselves. And so the museum comes around the same time where also in political theory the notion of the individual becomes very important, like one person, one vote, like the whole kind of rise of democracy in Western societies. And that was a big debate around the time, like how could we produce whatever you want to call it, a ritual, event, an architecture where people could move freely as individuals. Like until then, rituals were only, the rituals we know would be like this. You are a collective. No, like I'm addressing you as the audience, you know, and you have to be here at a certain time, and you're kind of in the dark, unfortunately, so the museum is the exhibition, which also comes together with the department store, is the they there, the first architectures where individuals can walk freely. And if one looks again at these social reformers, they're very worried that this would work. They didn't trust the mob to actually be able to, you know, control themselves or behave themselves properly. So at the beginning, a lot of museums actually were functioned via guided tours. No? So this notion of the individual is one of the key notions which is supposed to be exercised in when you go to an exhibition, which also happens to the idea of the artist. The artist always being this individual person who signs. That's the signing, or today when we have it on the label, it's always important that this painting or this sculpture or this work of art has been made by somebody and an individual. And we are looking at this individual's subjectivity, and these individual subjectivities are plural. And so that's why, let's say at MoMA or at any museum, there's a plurality of subjectivities. So like our society, Western societies are pluralistic democracies which value difference, and different subjectivities, and all are valuable. So you can have Duchamp and Pollock, although in a certain way there's probably some, you know, major difference between the two worldviews. And and so the notion of the individual is one of the notions which one of the, let's say, I think there are four, my opinion, one of the four notions which gets ritually enacted or exercised in this civilizing ritual, the museum. So that's one. I'm not against that. I'm very much pro that. That's why for me it's impossible to stand and do a talk alone without Glenn and Li Wing-mei sitting next to me, because I feel like I'm doing a theater show, which I did earlier. So I'm very much, I mean, earlier in my life. So that would be number one. This ritual is about individuals. The second thing, it's about, which is probably the most known, it's about exercising or training a linear notion of time. So in the 18th century, you know, coming out of medieval times, it was not so clear that, as it is for us clear today, this idea of a kind of linear time where we're going to move forward. Still cyclical ideas, or kind of like a static kind of state, was much more prevalent. So, you know, the museum is definitely not the only new institution of social training in the 18th century, but one of its principal institutions which train people to an idea of a linear notion of time, so the creation of a past. The museum is the institution which creates a past, and then, now here's a ritual aspect, which you can walk through. So the walking, so basically what the museum does is it spatializes time, so you can walk through time, and at the end of the museum, at the end of the, like in the classical museum, which is chronological, at the end of the, there's the greatest moment, which is now, which is us, and that's the ideology of the chronological classical museum, which nowadays has been a bit deconstructed, but in its core still, I think, is still an undercurrent. So traditionally, that was definitely one thing that this ritual was supposed to train. But I think still there today, also what we always put. Years, like on a, even if we don't hang chronologically necessarily, we still put years. Now we still say 2004 or 1945, so we can place this in our head, like this kind of development during time. We don't just create a total experience with lots of works and then that's it. Then I think another thing that this ritual, the museum or the exhibition, enacts, and that's very important to me, is, of course, the importance of the notion of the material object. So that's, again, another thing that I find quite new, radical, and unbelievable in a way, is that the exhibition is the first ritual which really has the object as its centerpiece. If you think of any other ritual, like in a kind of... more like it's thought of as the in the program, some weird rituals we enact, it's always between people. And here we have, I was speaking to an anthropologist from Colombia some years ago, and he agreed on that there's no other ritual where the thing itself is the protagonist. So that's also one of the basic intuitions of my work, that I just as a teenager already found that very strange, that if you go into a museum room, that you will look, that the person standing there, the museum guard, is basically non-existent. So it would be if I come to Glenn and I would go like, instead of saying, hi, Glenn. No? And but that's exactly what the exhibition or the museum does. It's like somehow this thing is more important than Glenn. No? Glenn being the museum guard. What? and that's where my trouble starts to come, because I think that one can of course also explain, because the kind of these rising Western democracies, they were of course based on this process of industrialization, which, you know, was an idea we can produce wealth through transforming the earth into things. And that's basically the core logic of our society today. And that's why I don't think it's by coincidence that all these museums are being now built. They are the central rituals of our time, because they reflect what we are focused on, this transformation of nature into things. And that, you know, I do think is an issue for me. As you know, some of you are familiar with my work, I try to skip that part. No, then I think the fourth notion, then I guess I'll stop, is the idea of the product, or as one used to say in the 60s, the commodity. No, and so also in the museum, I think this is something that I advise to everybody. If you go and listen to a children's tour, go and listen to a children's tour, and then you just wait for 10 or 20 minutes, and I'll make a bet with some of Leeuwing May's origami dollars, if he gives me one, that at one moment the tour guide will say, and this is so valuable, you know, it's very expensive to the kids. So the kids, but that goes for us as well, we are trained on the fact that the material object has a value in terms of its meaning, but also an economic value. Things are valuable. This seems like very basic stuff, but that's what rituals do. Rituals enact really basic stuff of a society, and that's another point that I don't really have a problem with. But so the third point was the material object. That would be the one that I'd try to change, and also the idea of a linear notion of time. I'm not sure if that's really something I'd want to affirm, but maybe that's also something that I'd maybe not really able to criticize, because I'm maybe too ingrained in this kind of modern idea of time progression. I can't really imagine something else. And the first idea of the individual is something which is very, very important to me, that there's a ritual for individuals, because I think that's the way we understand ourselves. And I believe that that's an okay thing, and that's why I love the exhibition.
Thank you, Tino. I was struck by a couple of things you said that really set up a kind of dialectic. This issue of the individual and the museum, because museums are about a collective space, and the individual is precisely at the opposite end of that spectrum. And in fact, I think at some point you've even said that museums are spaces where citizenship is reflected. And I wonder how you see that tension between the individual and the collective.
Yeah, thanks. I'm very happy that you asked this question, because, that was maybe something that I didn't point out strongly enough, that the museum is, of course, a place which highlights the individuality of each one of us, or addresses us as an individual, but still there is a certain notion or a certain idea of collectivity also performed in the museum. And maybe allow me to do an example, maybe a historical example, which will make this clearer. So let's imagine we are in antiquity in Greece. You know, and so, as most of you know, in antiquity in Greece, not a lot of people were actually part of society. You know, like women or slaves, they were basically not really full members of society. So when this society in Athens would gather to kind of reflect upon itself, you know, a theater in Athens would be enough. Basically everybody could be there. You know? So now if you think of a democracy, which at least, you know, ideally everybody has one vote, everybody is part of society, and we have big nation states, how are you going to render visible or these masses? So that's why we go from a form, in my opinion, we go from a format like theater, which is this kind of condensed thing, to a museum where the citizenry, or the masses, or whatever you want to call it, they can, over the whole year, during the whole day, they can come there and they are rendered visible. Like the sovereign is rendered visible, which is kind of also quite clear in the Louvre. It was the prince's castle, or whatever you want to call it, and then it was turned into the museum. So this place with the new sovereign, the people can be rendered visible. So I think the notion of collectivity, which is in the museum, is a very contemporary one, which one can criticize for good reason, but I don't. Which is kind of individualized and kind of there can be collectivity. We see each other, we're in relation, but we remain individuals. If we want to talk to each other, we could, but we don't have to. We don't have to be there at the same time. We could come together as a group. So it's a very kind of fragmentized and flexibilized idea of collectivity, but still it's a collective place because somehow we go there together, but we have no possibility, and that is our experience, we have no possibility of looking towards the edges of the collective we are part of. You know that you're part of the collective United States, and I know that I'm part of the collective Berlin or Europe or whatever, but in either case, I don't have a possibility to understand all of it or to see all of it. So the museum is a machine, let's say, which also tries to render this visible. Although, of course, it can never fully render it visible. So I do think there's a notion of collectivity there, but it's less strong than this notion of individuality.
Ningwei, let me turn to you for a moment and ask you to elaborate a little bit on the various strands that have gone into so much of your work, this background deeply steeped in Buddhism with its rituals, its traditions, its history, and Catholicism with a very different set of rituals and certainly a very different tradition. And I wonder how you negotiate those two very different modes of understanding the world and how that's reflected in your work.
Okay. It's a bit difficult, I have to say. I'll just share a little story of my childhood in the Chan Buddhist in Taipei. I went to live there every summer starting from 6 years old. I remember going there, I was very rambunctious, and because when I was growing up in Taiwan, I was watching things like Charlie's Angels and Brady Bunch American TV. So when I went to the monastery, there was absolutely nothing in there, no electricity and no TV. But what my teacher or the monk taught me was the idea of silence, which was very, very difficult when you're 6 years old, to a point that he almost wanted to smack me that because I kept chatting away. One day he asked me to go into this little room with two tatamis, and he closed the door, and I thought, uh-oh, what's going to happen here? What he did was that he handed me an apple and said, we'll spend the next hour in here together, and you have exactly 1 hour to tell me what an apple is. And I thought, oh, that's very easy. You know, apple is something sweet, something sour, it's red, it's good tasting. You know, after 30 seconds, I just stopped talking, and I didn't know, I mean, what to say, and that was the longest 59 minutes in my whole life. So that really made me aware on the power of words and also the power of silence. And even until today, I don't do sketch nor I try not to make objects like you, because I think that experience really taught me that leaving things behind myself is not the most, it's not the best way to do it, because often I remember when my teacher walked in the garden, he would take a broom and just try to brush his footstep. But I kept asking him, but your brush is making the mark. And he just stared at me like, I don't know what you're up to. So I felt that it really influenced my work that I do not make things and also try to make documents. So what you saw just now in terms of images, what I usually do is I'll ask the participant to come back again after my performance in order to restage that particular moment, because I think having a camera in there, it really, really changed the state of mind between myself and the performer. It's almost like the state of an electron. When you examine it, it changes to the opposite state. And with the Catholic upbringing, that was very much when I came to San Francisco and went to a Benedictine school. And that was very different because it's all about being guilty and all about leaving things behind and try to ask for forgiveness of what things you've done. So I think, luckily, the Zen Buddhist stayed within me stronger than the Catholic one. And I'm very grateful for that. Thank you.
Tina, I want to pick up a little bit on this issue of leaving things behind, the trace, if you wish, the material object. And you have been so assiduous in your work to, in a way, challenge all of us who work in museums about that object, that trace. And I wonder if you would talk for a moment about two aspects of your work. One, your insistence that these situations that you create are not performances, and why performance for you is something both different and inappropriate in the context of your work, and also your insistence that your work not be photographed.
Yeah, I'm still thinking about what Li Wenmei was saying. Maybe I can bring it a bit together. I think that I just feel that, like, in the last, like thinking on large terms and like large, you know, in like on the dimension of eras. And I think that the museum for me is also an interesting place because it's one of the rare places in our society where we think in dimensions of eras. No, so I feel like legitimized to do that here. I think, let's say, the last 200-300 years, again, is this phase where you know, some people decided, okay, we're really fed up with, you know, lack and, you know, just this kind of constant material suffering of not having enough. And they kind of implemented, you know, methods, probably like the scientific method, and which resulted in lots of technology, which produce all these things which we are surrounded by today. And I'm not necessarily against that, but I think that we overestimate their power. Like, we would be like, let's say our culture would be like a bit like a teenager who's kind of startled by its own power but hasn't managed to really control them. So in that sense, I'm interested in what you're saying about this monk. I don't think that things are necessarily bad or that we don't need them or that they should be done away with or left behind or something. I just think that we overestimate their value, that there's other things, you know, like what Li Wenmei was talking about, this kind of work on the self, that's the actual site of a life and of work. And the site of working is not this kind of constant transformation of the earth. So that resonated with me, although I guess I'm, you know, coming from a more secular background, but I am interested in, you know, what this Buddhist monk said to you, and also your chatting aspect, this kind of not being able to focus. And I do think, you know, it's a kind of cliche, but it's also, most cliches are true, that's part of our culture. We're kind of a chattery culture. And not that I'm against chatting or gossiping, but I mean, like, in a metaphorical sense, no? So that's where my bias is. Then why you use the word assiduous, I think, because I think, you know, my work tries to be like a kind of experiment and say, well, okay, we think these things, nowadays we think these things are so deeply important and we can't do without them. Well, why don't we try what happens when we do just leave them behind for a moment, you know? And that's just my art, you know? So in life, of course, I have my favorite things and stuff, you know? So I definitely think that things are important, but it's more like an experiment to see, well, how important are these things actually and what happens? Like, and that was for me kind of an open-ended question at the beginning when I started out. It was really like an experiment with myself. Okay, let me try to produce something which is not a thing and let's see how far I can get with that. Mm-hmm. And I was astonished how far. I didn't expect to be sitting here with you today. Seriously not, no? And maybe it's going to be like kind of deadening, no? But mm-hmm. turned out to be, at least for some people, you know, livening. Mm-hmm. And so I guess that's my position. So I hope that people don't think that my position is kind of essentialist, like I'm trying to radically done away with them. But I think in an artistic oeuvre, you have to formulate things quite clear so that people have something to communicate with. If it's kind of blurred, I don't think that's that efficient.
There's an aspect of your work, though, that's always struck me that links it almost to pre-literate societies, because it's really about oral transmission. There are no formal written instructions. Each situation, each event depends upon a very small group of people being able to teach or train another group of people to carry this tradition on. And of course, each time that happens, something changes. It's probably impossible that the first set of instructions can be transmitted absolutely whole. And so I wonder how you feel about the ways in which your work actually does change as different people are involved and as these instructions are altered over time. Oh, and is that important or not important to the work's essence?
No, in my opinion, I try to answer both questions, because in my opinion, there's two questions in that. One is this kind of oral transmission, how I see that, and the other thing is how this kind of variation in my works. And I guess towards the first point, that's again similar to what I said before. I still think even our societies today, we have these big archives like libraries, museums, and other kinds of archives. Still, you know, it's much more important, and knowledge gets transmitted by your mother, basically. You know, and we have
speak for yourself.
Well, or by people around you, you know? And I was looking at you. No, I didn't mean you personally. I meant like.
I'm teasing.
So, no, I have no idea about your mother. I mean, you could tell me later.
Neither do I. That's the problem. Neither do I. That's the problem.
Yeah. For me, it was, again, like I said before, this kind of experimental thing of saying, well, I think still body-to-body oral transmission is the main channel through which knowledge gets transmitted, even in our days, and I want to highlight that and to see show that that's still possible. No? Although, you know, I don't have anything against archiving stuff. It's definitely our cultures are well off with doing that. And then the second thing about variation, yeah, I do think that variation is life. And there's maybe a streak, but I'm not so sure about what I'm going to say now. There's a Western streak in trying to arrest life in the thing. But this is kind of, I don't know, maybe a bit beyond my level. And maybe I'm not so into that. Mm-hmm. I don't want to arrest time or arrest life. I'm happy for life to have variation, and I'm happy to somehow, you know, construct into that and have this variation be part of my work. And so often my works are built anyway in a way that, depending on who interprets them or their rule base or how they are kind of acted out or how the rules are played out, it's different each time anyway. So if it's done differently in the future, that's not a radically or categorical difference to the way they were now. No? So it doesn't seem to be such an issue for me. I mean, definitely what I'd never do, like I'd never make kind of very, I mean, KISS that you, you know, I'm very glad that your museum acquired, but that's one of the few works, and it's an 8-minute choreographic loop. This is one of the few works which are really detailed, but it's 8 minutes, so I think it's possible to memorize that. But other than that, I've increasingly gone to kind of rule-based structures because I think, well, you can easily remember some rules. Like, you wouldn't think, like, American football, which I don't understand, but you guys understand, that these rules will somehow be forgotten, or basketball. Mm-hmm. They're kind of commonsensical. Basketball, let's say, is commonsensical. Basketball, I want to understand the rules of basketball. One doesn't need a library necessarily. One is not worried that there will be. So I'm trying to go more towards that direction. What I wouldn't do is, let's say, choreograph a kind of 45-minute choreography, kind of like Balanchine, which I'd love to, but then say, well, this is my new work. You know, that would be difficult without to keep that amount of detail. So I've built that somehow. I've built that into the structure of the work itself. That it, you know, for two reasons: keep it simple, but on the other hand, I keep it variating anyway, because I think that's a higher degree of complexity which can be produced through rule-based structures. If you look also at choreographers like William Forsythe, I don't know if he comes to New York sometimes, but if you see these big group scenes in Forsythe's ballets, where it's like amazingly complex and you have like no idea what's going on, but it seems like quite precise. Well, if you ask Bill, it's not choreographed anymore through like that moment, like one guy has his hand here and 10 others are like this or whatever. It's just like they have rules and that produces this complexity. So I've gone more and more, I've adopted this model.
Mm-hmm. Mingwei, I'm interested in sort of some of the people you've studied with and who've affected you. And I know that you studied with Suzanne Lacy, mm-hmm. Who in turn actually was a student, I guess, of Alan Kaprow.
Yes,
and,
that's right.
And that creates a kind of lineage, in mm-hmm. a way, of the artist as a public engager, as a public artist. And I wonder how you see your role as an artist, and what are the sort of moments for you that crystallize your work? Mm.
Before I answer your question, I have a little story about Alan Kaprow. Before I applied for Yale, I was so nervous, and I asked Suzanne, can I call Alan Kaprow just to chat with him, because he's the icon. Yeah? She said, yes, of course, give him a call. So I pick up the phone, I was very nervous, and Mr. Kaprow said hello. So instead of saying I'm doing conceptual art, I say, hello, this is Mingwei, I'm a conception artist. And he kept saying, what? Are you giving birth now? And which later I did the male pregnancy yes. project.
So perhaps that was his genesis.
Yes, that's right, yeah. So he was very generous, yeah. Anyway, so I am coming from a Chinese tradition. This whole idea of lineage is very important to me, because in traditional Chinese art, what you do is how you copy from your teacher for 20 years, and then you copy your great master's work for another 20 years, and if you're still alive, then you can do your little doodling if you want. So I feel this lineage is important, but I also feel it's important for me to know the lineage, but also be something different, and also know the difference there. And another person I studied with was Mark Thompson, who we all call him the beekeeper. He basically worked with bees. And I remember very vividly, because when I was helping him keep bees in California, doing one of his installation, a lot of bees die because the ventilation was not working well for the bees, and they all died when we came in. And I took a broom and started brushing the bees into a pile. He walked in and stopped me right there and say, they were individual life. Can you just pick them up one by one and not just brush them off like that? And it really, really made me realize the word of sincerity, because nobody's watching that interaction between us, and I could just brush it off. And I hopefully my work is based on that kind of idea, and then go somewhere else with that. Thank you.
Maybe I can ask you one thing about this Chinese lineage.
Yes.
No? Uh-huh. That you said 20 years, one has to...
To imitate your teacher's sure. drawing, yes. Yeah.
And what would your relation be to that? Are you do you agree with that, or are you critical mm-hmm. towards that? Because I was not sure.
Yes. I think I'm neither critical nor agreeing with it, just because that was my tradition. And but my Western training was completely different, because the idea of copying or imitating someone's work, pretending your work, that's really the death of your career. In fact, I actually did a project called Through Master's Eyes that I took a classical painting, asked six people to copy the original one. But the way it's copied is that the first one copied from the 16th century master, the second one copied from the first one, and third one copied from the second one. So you see the evolution of that each one of them became the master of the previous one, and therefore having their own relationship and creativity. So I, in a way, I believe in that system. Also thinking in classical Chinese, the way to pass down particularly music is through listening to your teacher play, and nothing is written down. So let's say 3,000 years of Zheng music, nothing has ever been written down. It's all from one person to the person, and thinking each generation is about 20 years old. So things are very organic, like you were saying. It's not static, although it's through word of mouth, and it's extremely vulnerable and impermanent, but also organic and beautiful. Yeah.
One of your projects that you didn't talk about, but that that for me at least has always resonated, is the 100 Days with Lily, which to me is all about a kind of reverence and coming to terms with the fragility of life and the way in which memory is inscribed.
Yes.
And I wonder if you would talk about that project for
yes.
a moment.
Yes, okay. That was a project that I did for my grandmother when she passed away in early 90s. My grandmother was, we were not very close, but she was definitely an icon for me. She was the very first Taiwanese Western medicine doctor. When she passed away, I didn't really know what to do. So what I did, after talking to Mark and Suzanne, they told me that I should really use a ritual that I know of, not a ritual that was taught to me. I should use that to really experience this particular thing called impermanence. So what I did was that I took a lily, a water lily bulb, and planted, and from that very moment on, I carried this plant 24/7 and experienced its germination, the blooming of lily, the flowering, and the death of the lily, because whenever you take a plant around, walking around, it actually goes through the cycle very quickly. It's different than static. So after that, I took the bulb and put it back in earth. And in Taiwanese tradition, when it's in a bulb form, it looks kind of like a male gonad. It looks like a scrotum, so it's a male male organism. However, when it goes through a blooming process, it becomes a female. And that really also brings in this whole idea of my own gender issue. So that project really made me realize that whatever I do, it really affects people around me. Although it's such a simple ritual as carrying a plant around, people also project their own feeling and history onto someone who walking around in this cloak and also having a plant around. Someone actually thought I was a priest. So, because at that time I was working in the mission district and sitting in the bus at the end, someone will come and do a sort of confessional conversation with me all the time. And luckily I went to Catholic school, so I sort of know what that was about. but again, it really, the ritual could be a collective experience, or it could be stemmed from your own private experience. Yeah.
I'm quite interested in what you're saying. I think that there's definitely some things that interest me, but there's also some differences. That I think that what I was trying to say at the beginning, that for me the ritual is something which is already there. We are already in this ritual, and for you the museum or the exhibition space seems less important. Also, when I was seeing your work, that it can also take place in the public space outside of that. I'm still thinking about, if I'm allowed to, thinking about this Chinese lineage stuff, because I think that's quite interesting and kind of ambivalent. That in the sense that on the one hand, I'd say, like I was saying before, that we ourselves, you know, in the West, we are still following a similar model. You know, you go and you learn, like you have Susan And then we get taught, and I have similar people, even if I didn't go to proper art school, but I definitely have people who I'm in a lineage with, yes. And I don't think you can exist without that. But I think a specific Western thing, and this is maybe also something to add on to what I was saying right at the beginning, is that okay, we have 4 years or 5 or 10, but then produce difference,
yes.
And don't produce repetition, no?
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a very, again, has to this idea with a linear time, because it's always a linear time into the unknown.
Mm.
And we have a big valorization of the unknown, I think, more than in Asia, and of kind of moving on. And that's why I was interested when you said that would have been deadening for my career or something you said. And that's exactly because a Western society needs difference.
Yes.
It's kind of conventional. Its convention is to produce unconventionality or something.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing, you know, the West is under a lot of critique, but I do think that is quite strange and sophisticated, no? Yeah. And that's one thing why I like art, because it's a weird sphere where somehow it becomes itself by contradicting itself. That's deeply Western, but has to do, again, to do with this idea of propelling yourself into this kind of unknown future.
Yeah. And go ahead. Yeah.
No, that was it.
I think the idea of imitation and copying also, it's quite relevant in the Western sense in the Roman Greco time, that when you go to the Met now, all the Roman sculpture were copies of ancient Greek sculpture. So I think it's probably only until fairly recently, for the past 200 years or 100 years, that the idea and the promotion of creating something extremely new that really took root. And I could see in the East, that idea really, really affect people. People are aware of their tradition, but it's also in contemporary art that you are supposed to create your own voice. And that idea really came very strongly at the end of 18th century, beginning of 1900. The whole idea of Western influence coming into the East. Yeah.
Do you still spend some time in Taiwan, or do you sometimes go to China, or not at all?
Yeah, I actually just got back from Taipei two days ago.
Because how would you see China? I don't know, maybe Glenn, you know more about this. But I don't know anything. I've been to China once, but do they really... Is it difficult for them to grapple with this idea of the new or the different? I did have that feeling a little bit.
I think I'm not that familiar with mainland China. I've only been there three times. I know with Taiwan, we are very much about, we want to be different, especially because of the political situation between Taiwan and China, that we try to be different. On the other hand, it's interesting enough that, however, the Taiwanese also try to be the player of the traditional Chinese, because thinking the mainland Chinese destroyed most of the traditional value in China in the 1960s and 70s under Mao Zedong. So a lot of my mainland Chinese friends who came to visit Taiwan, they're not really shocked by how modern it looks, but they're really shocked to see the really, really, really old Chinese Confucianism, Taoism still survive everywhere in Taiwan, and thinking that's where it came from, mainland China, but it doesn't exist there anymore. So it's fascinating. It's not a black and white answer. There's a very gray area there that culture and civilization thrives. Yeah.
This, before we turn this open to all of you, let me ask one more question of both of you, and as you in the audience think of questions yourselves. Both of your work... Each of your work is, in fact, quite different. And yet, I find that there's a very strong formal quality, that there's a kind of really powerful aesthetic and aesthetic dimension to what you do, that these are beautifully constructed, visually stunning works that you each produce. And I wonder to what degree you think about the aesthetic or the formal qualities of the projects you engage with and the environments or experiences that you are trying to create.
What do I think about that?
Is it important to you?
I think it's important, but it's not very important. Let's say it like that. It's not that like I'm against the idea of beauty, or but I don't probably more for it. But it's not a big issue for me either way. And there's definitely an aesthetic to my work, which definitely comes out of my lineage. It would be like Xavier Leroy, Jérôme Bell, choreographers like that. Like specifically in my work, there's this kind of minimal, like one of the most, let's say, signature stuff, which I come back to, which is one can clearly read out of a certain choreographical tradition, is this kind of turning your back or walking backwards, which reoccurs in my work number of times in different works, which is a kind of minimal way of producing artificiality. So without going kind of berserk and throwing our arms and legs around, just by turning around, that we are in a kind of artificial mode by walking backwards. So definitely there is an aesthetic, but I'm puzzled by your question. I don't really have a great answer to it.
Yeah. I think aesthetic is definitely an important part of me, either in an emotional or a physical component, because I feel that each one of us has that, what I call the point of beauty inside. And if you see something or experiencing something that's very beautiful, that thing actually becomes more beautiful because you project that feeling to it. So someone was asking me, for example, one of the projects I did is called the Sleeping Project, Sleep with Strangers. And I told them that the way I designed the whole bed, it's very simple. And just imagine if I designed a bed with like leopard print comforter with metal. That will provoke a very different kind of sleeping project, not the one I intended to. So it does make a big difference in terms of my own aesthetic, and hopefully people experience it the way I experience it, but it's difficult to control. However, we do have certain control to it. Yeah.
Questions in the audience? Please.
Phones on.
Yes.
Speak up, speak loudly so we can
we'll
all
bring one to you.
Hear you. And could you turn the lights up a little bit now?
Hi. This is a question for Mr. Lee. I've been a big fan of your work for a long time now. I think the main thing with your work, which I just love, is a sense of trust that you try to like build with us, and I just want to get your thoughts on how that sense of trust informs your life as well as your art, and how does your art blend into your life and vice versa.
Yes.
I mean, do you sometimes get frustrated and stressed out with people?
Okay, yes.
And how does, I mean, how do you keep that sense of openness and trust?
Yes, thank you. Okay. Yeah. So the question is about trust. I also, when I started doing my own practice, I also have a lot of questions about that. Because as you know, doing these kind of open-ended projects, you really have to trust your audience to come up with something fascinating and interesting. Go back to the best project that I can use as an example is the Sleeping Project, because that really deals with trust between strangers. So through a lottery, I selected 20 volunteers, and each one of them come to the museum and sleep with me in separate beds, and they come at 9 o'clock, leave early in the morning or whatever they want to. So this dance of two people really began at 9 o'clock, and if the person didn't really feel right in the first 5 minutes, it really, really collapsed. The first two nights, I was so nervous that I was having stomach ache. And I was living in Brooklyn at that time, so on the way back, this after the second sleepover, on the way back to Brooklyn, I was sobbing uncontrollably in the subway because I was just under so much stress. And after that experience, I took a long walk in the park. I realized the only way I can do and continue that project is to be as open as a child in terms of to be receiving and not imagining what could happen to me if someone attacks me. Because I feel the only way, if someone sees a baby, the intuition is to protect this baby rather than if you see someone who is all armed up, then you probably would just go and poke him and attack him. So that mental change really was very, very critical in terms of this project and all my other project that deals with participation, that I completely trust my participant. And once you, as a participant, realize there is this trust, unspoken trust there, then that part of you comes and participate in it. After 12 years of doing what I'm doing, I didn't ever have an experience that was unpleasant or people took advantage of the trust. So I really felt very grateful that people took my work seriously and participate with such sense of trust. But it had to come from me first. Yeah. What about you, Tina? What about this trust issue for you with your audience and you're a performer?
Definitely people have spoken about that. It's not like the word which occurred to me, but I guess I'm also grateful that other people will just step in. It's not that I'm worried that I have to trust them, but I'm grateful that they would even participate. And I do have a lot of belief that an individual which comes to see my work will, you know, in the work where you somehow have to create the work as well, mostly through conversation, that they will produce, that everybody has, like you said, an inner point of beauty at some moment. Yeah. I think anybody has an inner point of intelligence maybe or something. So I think that trust, I'm probably for it, but for me it's not an issue because trust somehow, I mean, this will be my first association, maybe also anticipates a kind of worry about the capacities of the other. Then you have to trust him and project. I'm not so worried about the others. I think they're fine.
Yeah. Critics have talked a bit, Tino, about the issue of gamesmanship in your work. Do you want to elaborate on that?
What does gamesmanship mean?
Yeah. And
what does that mean, that English word?
I'm curious as well. I mean, usually it implies some sort of artificiality, some effort at generating a rules-based relationship between people or between events.
So gamesmanship is the craftsmanship of producing a game? I'm not, my English is sometimes a bit flawed.
Yeah, I think you could put it in that context.
Well, if I understand them correct, yeah. I haven't read these where you read that, but I would take that as a compliment. Yeah, I'd love to try and construct a game which is balanced, which works. No, like soccer is a constructed game, but it needs the offside rule to function, to be balanced. And I guess my work, the recent works, let's say from 2005 on, which are rule-based, they have to strike such a balance, otherwise they kind of they simply don't work. So I don't know if that's what your question was, no. but definitely that's something that I'm interested in. Yeah.
More questions? Yes.
Hello. I have a question for Tino. I think apart from the fact that your works are very beautiful to look at, or that they situate the visitor in moments that they usually don't find themselves in a museum, I think one of the most interesting thing of your practice is the act of selling, that you actually sell your immaterial work. And I was so fortunate to be present at one of those acquisitions, and they were very ritual-like. I mean, I think the act of selling is always a ritual, but I think because of the fact that the object was missing, there was no contract, there was nothing written down. You made it very clear, or you turned the act of selling into a ritual, or you made the ritualistic character very obvious. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that aspect in your work.
I mean, it relates maybe back to what I say in the beginning. I mean, it depends if you have a narrow or wider definition of ritual. The narrow definition of ritual would be somehow informed by this idea that we're somehow in a circle and doing something together. And a wider one would be, like I tried to say in the beginning, some kind of transitional experience. And it's true that when we do this sales of a work, that technically there is actually a contract, just not a written contract, and the ritual, if you want to call it, or the ritualistic dimension, is this gathering where we discuss and agree upon this, where we agree upon this contract, and we discuss it, and we you know, the different conditions of which underlie this transaction are said and discussed. Like, to give an example, for example, the first condition is always, because it's, the contract is actually always the same, the oral contract, is that the work can be can only be installed by myself or a person authorized by myself. So it's somebody who knows the piece, mostly somebody who has done it before. Or another clause would be that it has to be shown for a minimum of 6 weeks, so it doesn't become a kind of theatrical event in retrospect. And these are things that often which get discussed. And we're sitting around mostly a table in an office or something, and maybe that's what you called the, I don't know how you said it exactly, ritualistic dimension. It's true, it has this thing of gathering. I think also when we think of ritual, we think of this kind of we're in one time and place together. Like, you can't think of a ritual in the internet, or then my wider conception, that would be possible, but I think the connotations are more we're in a place and time together. And that's maybe why it feels to you more like a kind of ritual, because we are suddenly there, you know, time and place together, acting something out, agreeing on something which normally would be done through kind of, you know, crossing a spatial distance. Somebody would send the work, it would be opened, and somebody else would send an invoice, and all of that is kind of, we never gather together. I guess that's one of the connotations of ritual, is to gather, but I'm not sure if that's necessarily true in a wider connotation. I mean, the museum is an interesting hybrid, like we talked before, where it's somehow a gathering, but somehow not. Now, when Glenn asked me about this collective notion of the museum, so yeah, I guess that's what I can say about that.
I would say it does one. It goes one step further than that. Certainly, from the museum's perspective, and I should say to all of you, the acquisition for us of the KISS was one of the most complicated and difficult acquisitions we've ever made. Not because the work was so expensive that one had to find thousands of donors, or because the artist was so difficult that we had to convince him to sell it to us, but rather the very nature of an acquisition in which there is no formal record other than the dialogue between Tino and the museum creates a condition that relates very much to your question, which is it imposes a level of trust that most transactions don't have to deal with, because there's a formal record and it doesn't depend on your believing in the institution and the institution believing in you and thus agreeing to a condition that hasn't existed before. And I think this issue of the transactional side of acquisition implicates the museum actually in the work of art. And I thought that was one of the most interesting dimensions, that the museum no longer is simply a passive recipient of an object, but now commits itself to be an active player, to pick up the games analogy again. For us, it was a really a voyage. So are we. Yes.
If Tino could answer the two questions Glenn asked earlier on about not characterising this as performance, and then about the controlling or trying to restrict the record, the visual record. I know that probably comes closer to some of the things you said about not wanting to arrest things, but could you answer those two things?
Well, it's true that I didn't answer before because I thought that there were other things which I thought would be more interesting to discuss between the three of us, and there was another part of your question, and I did do that deliberately. So now you're bringing me back. One of the reasons why I don't like to answer this question, but I will, is because there's so many reasons, so I would bore you to death. Probably, like, I think for both questions there would be 7 reasons, so that would make 14 in total, so that we'd be here at 9 o'clock. I have a big ego, but it has limits, you know, so I wouldn't want to hold you up so long. And the other thing that I think it's, not that important. There's definitely some importance put to it in the reception that I've been grateful to receive. So that's why I'm not so hot on answering it. But the strategy I've found, because not answering would also be impolite, is that I'd say like 1 or 2 reasons for each one. And so each time I choose a different reason. So let's start with the performance. Let's say 2 reasons for why it's not a performance. First of all, because it's misleading. It's factually wrong. Performance is something, by definition, you know, a kind of theatrical event which you go to at a certain time, you know, and you gather as a collective, you know, and then it starts and it ends. And my work is more on the temporality of visual art. So, for example, when I talk to journalists, I try to say that reason because I think people will really think that it's that they have to come at a certain time just by using that word. The other reason, which is maybe more important, is that just maybe the same importance. It's just that performance always sounds like performance art. Mm-hmm. And performance art, without going into too much detail, just has an ideological stance which is very much opposed to mine, which would be basically against the institution, against the market, and against repetition or kind of passing over to future generations, you know, intergenerational exchange. So I don't think that institutions are necessarily qua definition a bad thing. They regulate human interaction over generations. They're kind of a storer of human knowledge. There can be institutions which are bad, but that's for specific reasons. Institutions are not bad per se, and the museum is not bad per se, I think. Then the market is something, you know, having a small background as an economist, the market, and that has been discussed widely by a lot of art historians, the kind of what one calls the kind of failure of the avant-garde. The market is something that you can't be outside of, and you can't want to be outside of if you're doing something specialized. So if you're doing something specialized, and most of us want to do something specialized, then you have to somehow trade the specialization at one moment for something else for your food, basically, you know. Mm-hmm. And the other thing about the market is that it's a very constructed thing. So we can agree upon anything to be a product. So it's impossible to do anything which by definition can't be a product. No, if I say I'm going to pay you $1,000 to stop rotating with your foot, then that's a product. No? And if you don't agree, though, no, sorry, that was actually wrong. What I said. If I offer to pay you, that was wrong. What I said. If I offer to pay you $1,000 to, and then you agree, then it's a product. So it needs 2 people. No, 1 is not enough. So you can't kind of substantially decide a priori what's going to be a product or not. So that, I think, was one of the shortcomings of these kind of avant-garde. And then they were for this idea of the moment, like the one amazing moment, and then this can never be repeated. And also this kind of romanticism or kind of, I think, kind of arrogance of the artist. It's art because it's the artist doing it. I'm very much against that. Like this kind of putting yourself so much into the center, which then also is linked to this thing of the moment, because you can't get it away from your body, you know? Mm-hmm. And it can't be repeated. So my model is more a model of difference and repetition than the kind of one unrepeatable moment. You know? So that would be, you know, there would be probably 4 or 5 other things to say about just this, but that's why I think it's just a whole different ideology. And I prefer, you know, when we humans communicate, you try to use words which will make your position understandable, not one which will kind of cloud it. Then about documentation, let me just give one reason why I don't do it, is because I don't need it. It relates to the last thing I said, because as my work can be repeated and I collaborate with a kind of with an archive, for example, MoMA, which I'm very happy about, and they can, you know, if they want to, they can show KISS, you know, whenever they want. And maybe they never show it, maybe they show it successively for a few years, and you can go to this archive, to this medium, the museum, and see it there, and you can see the real thing. And why would I want to make a photo of it if you could see the real thing? No, but if I make a performance, of course, and it happens once in some locker somewhere in, I don't know, in the West Coast, then of course I have to make a photo of it. No.
Yes.
This question's for Lee. From what you've said, I feel like that I've heard that you have really three main constituents in your work, yourself, the participants, yes, such as like the person sleeping beside you, and then the viewer. Do you give precedence to one of those three?
I think the viewer comes last, because, for example, like the sleeping project or dining project or the tourist, there's no viewers watching this dance between these two strangers. What they see really is the sort of leftover things the next morning. So that the question of a performance, that also it's in my mind, because for me, that kind of thing needs an audience, but we don't really have an audience. So the performer are the one who are the audience. So I do think the audience part of it comes very last. Yeah, if they see whatever. And part of it also depends on the oral history that somebody say, oh, I did that project, or I heard that project. So that is a very different experience than when you actually own my project by participating in it. So the 20 people who slept with me actually own the sleeping project. Without going through a monetary exchange, it's really a psychological and mental ownership of the work.
Other questions?
I have a question. I'm wondering, you're showing your work now, but in the future, after you're gone, if you stop doing your work, or unfortunately, if you pass away, how would people know your work ever existed? How would you show your work? I know here at the museum, you're talking about archiving, and people are involved with it, but once the work is no longer exhibited and you're no longer living, how would work be passed on?
Wow, this is fascinating. It's a first for me. Thank you for the question. Yeah, it's... Well, it's like what I said before when Jenny asked the question about the selling of the work. I talked about this one clause that the work can be installed or rehearsed by me or somebody authorized by me. So, for example, in the case of KISS, there's a number of people who are authorized to know the choreography, and so in the future, you know, I'm looking forward to also teach people here in New York, and then I will point them out and tell Glenn, who works here at the Museum in Conservation, and say these are the people, and those are the people who know the work. Then eventually I will have to set up something where the museum might take care that they teach it to other people. So there has to be somebody who's authorized to authorize other people. That is important. That's probably something I didn't mention before, but I will probably at one moment in my life also set up a kind of organization which one can come to, where if one has a work but one doesn't know how to put it into place, that they will then take care and put it into place.
Mm-hmm. Questions in the back? Yes, in the middle.
This is a question for Tino. It's about your process when you're developing work. Do you write things down, or is it all oral, or do you, or is it just discussions with your collaborators?
No, I never write things down. It has also part to do with that I'm a bit lazy, but also kind of conviction. So I think that if I have an idea and I can't remember it, then it can't be such a good idea. No? And
wait till you get a little older.
I'll end up doing less work. Yeah. And I've already slowed down. And no, I never write. Never write things down. It's just not my nature. Also, I don't feel that urge. It's not that I restrict myself from doing it. And with the more complicated, more rule-based works, like I don't know if some of you may have seen the work at Marion Goodman's gallery last year or last winter. That is almost like a studio, but in my head. So I know some of the parameters, and it takes me months or years, and I have some of the parameters of what it's supposed to produce, what it's supposed to generate for a visitor. Mm. For me, I would say that would be one big difference. The visitor comes first. Mm. And I know what I want to produce in a visitor, and I'm thinking, how could I produce this? And that would take me months. And I'm adding elements like an artist would go to a studio and then rework it. But then when I, for example, that piece which some of you may have seen, The Situation, when I first showed it in Frankfurt, then it was basically 1 week of rehearsals with a small group of people who would be doing it. So it was their actual rehearsal where then I saw it for the first time. And that's the way it goes, yeah.
You, Mingwei, you talked about the fact that you don't sketch. So would you talk a little bit about your process in the same kind
yes,
of...
Yes, I really identify with Tino on not sketching or writing it down. The way I think is that ideas come to me like dreams. We all dream, and you don't go look for dreams. Dreams actually come to you. Some of the ideas are just not very interesting, and they go. But some of the ideas are very big ideas that could be, for me, a life-changing experience. But once I have that idea, maybe there's no situation to show it. So that idea would stay in my mind. And I often share my ideas with my best friends, and in a way using them as my studios, that when ideas are being planted in their mind, later on I'll go harvest it by asking them, so what do you think about that idea? And they actually start germinating, and they come back with 15 different versions. It's quite fantastic. And in a way, that's already a collaborative process. And when it's like a seed. When there's the right moment, the right water, right light, the seed will come and become a tree. But if it doesn't, it will just stay as a tree, or it just go away because it's not a very important idea. So, and also, I'm very lazy.
It seems to be a common thing.
Yes.
Let's take one more question, if there is one. If not, why don't we thank Li Mingwei and Tino Segal for an incredibly interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.